Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Girl Who Knew Too Much by Amanda Quick. Narrated by Louisa Jane Underwood. Chapter 1. The abstract painting on the bedroom wall was new. It had been painted in fresh blood. There was blood everywhere in the elegant white-on-white boudoir. It soaked the dead woman's silver satin evening gown and the carpet beneath her body. There was blood on the white velvet seat of the dainty chair in front of the pretty little dressing table. Anna Harris's first thought was that she had walked into the middle of a nightmare. The scene simply could not be real. She was asleep and dreaming. But she had grown up on a farm. She had hunted deer with her grandfather, caught and cleaned fish, helped deliver calves. She knew the cycle of life and the smell of death. Still, she could not leave the room until she made certain. Helen had collapsed on her side facing the wall. Anna crouched next to the body and reached out to check for a pulse. There wasn't one, of course. There was a gun, however. A small one. It lay on the carpet not far from Helen's right hand. Acting on instinct, she certainly wasn't thinking clearly now, Anna scooped up the weapon. It was then that she saw the message. Helen had used her own blood to write it on the silver-flocked wallpaper just above the baseboard. Run. And in that moment, Anna knew that the perfect new life she had been living for the past year was an illusion. The reality was a dark fairy tale. Run. She rushed down the hall to her lovely blue and white bedroom, pulled a suitcase out of the closet, and started flinging clothes into it. Like the shoes and the frock she was wearing, almost all of her wardrobe was new, the gift of her generous employer. "Can't have my private secretary looking like she shops at a second-hand store," Helen had said on several occasions. Anna was shaking so badly she could barely get the suitcase closed and locked. With effort, she managed to haul it off the bed. She went back to the closet and took the shoebox off the top shelf. Tossing the lid aside, she started to reach into the box for the money she kept inside. She had been in her late teens a few years earlier when the crash occurred. But, like so many others who had lived through the experience, she had no faith in banks. She kept her precious savings close at hand in the shoebox. She froze at the sight of what was inside the box. There was money, all right. Too much money. With all of her living expenses paid for by her employer, she had been able to save most of her salary for the past year, but she certainly had not saved anywhere near the amount that was in the box. Helen must have added the extra cash. It was the only explanation, but it made no sense. In addition to the money, there was a small leather-bound notebook and a letter written on Helen's expensive stationery. "Dear Anna, if you are reading this, it means that I have made the biggest mistake a woman can make. I have fallen in love with the wrong man. I am afraid that I am not the person you believe me to be. I apologize for the deception. Take the notebook, the money, and the car. Run for your life. Get as far away as possible and disappear. Your only hope is to become someone else. You must not trust anyone. Not the police, not the FBI. Above all, never trust a lover. I wish I could give you the glowing reference you deserve, but for your own sake, you must never let anyone know that you once worked for me. As for the notebook, I can only tell you that it is dangerous. I do not pretend to understand the contents. I would advise you to destroy it. But if the worst happens, you may be able to use it as a bargaining chip. I have always considered us to be two of a kind, women alone in the world who are obliged to live by our wits. I wish you all the best in your new life. Get as far away as possible from this house and never look back. Yours, with affection, Helen. Helen Spencer had been bold, adventurous and daring, a woman of the modern age. She had lived life with passion and enthusiasm, and for the past year, Anna had been caught up in her glittering, fast-paced world. If Helen said that it was necessary to run, then it was indeed vital that Anna run. She emptied the contents of the shoebox into her secretarial handbag. After a few seconds' hesitation, she put Helen's little gun inside as well. She closed the handbag, gripped it in one hand, hoisted the suitcase, and hurried out into the hall. When she went past Helen's bedroom, she tried not to look at the body, but she could not help herself. Helen Spencer had been ravishingly beautiful, an angelic blonde with sparkling blue eyes. Wealthy, charming, gracious, she had paid her small household staff, including her secretary, very well. In return, she had demanded loyalty and absolute discretion concerning her seemingly small eccentricities, such as her occasional demands for privacy and her odd travel schedule. Like the others on the mansion's very small staff, the middle-aged housekeeper and the butler, Anna had been happy to accommodate Helen. It had been an enchanted life, but tonight it was over. Anna went down the stairs. She had always known that her good fortune could not last. Orphans developed a realistic view of life early on. When she reached the ground floor, she went past Helen's study. She glanced inside and saw that the door of the safe was open. The desk lamp was on. There was a blue velvet bag inside the safe. She hesitated. Something told her that she had to know what was inside the velvet bag. Perhaps the contents would explain what had happened that night. She set the suitcase on the floor, crossed the study, and reached into the safe. Scooping up the velvet bag, she loosened the cord that cinched it closed and turned it upside down over the desk. Emeralds and diamonds glittered in the lamplight. The necklace was heavy and old-fashioned in design. It looked extremely valuable. Helen had some very good jewelry, but Anna was sure she had never seen the necklace. It wasn't Helen's style. Perhaps it was a family heirloom. But the more pressing question was, why would the killer open the safe and then leave such an expensive item behind? Because he was after something else, she thought. The notebook. She slipped the necklace into the velvet sack and put it into the safe. She went back into the hall, picked up the suitcase, and rushed outside. The sporty Packard coupe that Helen had insisted upon giving her was waiting in the drive. She tossed the suitcase and the handbag into the trunk and got behind the wheel. And nearly went limp with gratitude and relief when the well-tuned engine started up on the first try. She turned on the lights, put the car in gear, and drove down the long, winding drive, through the open gates and away from the big house. She gripped the wheel very tightly and forced herself to concentrate. She had not learned all of Helen Spencer's secrets tonight, but she had stumbled upon enough of them to make one thing blazingly clear. She had to get as far away from New York as possible. The narrow mountain road twisted and turned on itself as it snaked down into the valley. A harrowing trip for those unaccustomed to it, especially at night. But her grandfather had taught her to drive when she was 13, and she had learned on bad mountain roads. She knew how to handle tight curves, and she knew this particular mountain road very well. She had driven her employer back and forth between the Manhattan apartment and the secluded mansion many times during the past year. Helen's faithful butler, Mr. Bartlett, had doubled as her chauffeur before Anna arrived at the mansion. but Bartlett's eyesight had begun to fail. Helen had been thinking of looking for a new driver when she hired Anna. Helen had been delighted to discover that, in addition to her stenography skills, her private secretary was also a skilled driver. "Saves me from having to hire a chauffeur," she had said. Helen had always been very keen on keeping staff to a bare minimum. She was not a stingy employer, just the opposite, in fact. But she had made it clear that she did not want a lot of people around her at the mansion. Tonight, it occurred to Anna that the reason Helen had limited the number of people on her household staff was because she had secrets to hide. "I've been incredibly naive," Anna thought. She had always prided herself on taking a cold-eyed, realistic view of the world. A woman in her position could not afford the luxuries of optimism, hope, and sentiment. For the most part, she considered herself to be quite intuitive when it came to forming impressions of others. But when she did make mistakes, the results tended to be nothing short of catastrophic. She reached the small sleepy village at the foot of the mountain and turned onto the main road. Unable to think clearly enough to come up with a destination, she pursued a random route, passing through a string of tiny towns. Run. She continued driving an erratic pattern straight through the next day, stopping only for gas and a sandwich. But at nightfall, exhaustion forced her to pull into an auto camp. The proprietors did not ask for a name, just enough money to cover the cost of a private cabin and a hot meal. She collapsed on a cot and slept fitfully until dawn. In her feverish dreams, she fled from an unseen menace, while Helen urged her to run faster. She awoke to the smell of coffee. A newspaper delivery truck arrived while she was eating the breakfast, provided by the couple who operated the camp. She bought a paper and unfolded it with a mix of dread and curiosity. The news of Helen Spencer's murder was on the front page. "Wealthy New York socialite savagely murdered. Private secretary missing. Wanted for questioning. Stolen necklace found in dead woman's safe." Shock iced Anna's blood. She was now a suspect in the murder of Helen Spencer. Helen's warning came back to her. "You must not trust anyone, not the police, not the FBI. Above all, never trust a lover." The last bit, at least, was easy enough, Anna thought. She did not have a lover. She had not had one since Bradley Thorpe. That humiliating debacle was the last occasion on which her intuition had failed quite spectacularly. She pulled herself back from the cliff edge of panic. She was a proud graduate of the Gilbert School for Secretaries. Gilbert girls did not panic. She had been trained to exert control over chaos. She knew how to set priorities. First things first, it was time to choose a destination. She could not continue to drive aimlessly up and down the East Coast. The very thought of spending weeks, months, or years on the run was enough to shatter her nerves. Besides, the money would not last forever. Sooner or later, she would have to go to ground, catch her breath, get a job, invent a new life. She was not the only person who had spent the night in the auto camp. The others gathered around the table for breakfast, eager to get back on the road. They chatted easily, sharing travellers' tales. All the conversation started the same way. "Where are you headed?" There were many answers, but one in particular stood out, because it sparked curiosity, wonder, and several nods of agreement around the table. By the time she finished breakfast, she had made her decision. She would do what countless others had done when they were forced to build new lives. She would head for that mythical land out west, where a vast blue ocean sparkled beneath a cloudless sky, and orange trees grew in people's backyards. A land where glamorous people created magic on the silver screen and got involved in titillating scandals in their spare time. A land where everyone was too busy inventing the future to care that she had no past. She got back behind the wheel and started driving west. Somewhere along the line, she came up with a new name for herself. Irene Glasson. It had a Hollywood ring to it, she thought. She found the highway to her future right where the other travelers had said it would be, in downtown Chicago. Route 66 would take her all the way to California. Chapter 2.
You failed.
Graham Enright folded his hands on top of the desk.
In addition to terminating Spencer, you were supposed to acquire the notebook.
Julian was standing in front of the Art Deco portrait on the wall, examining it with the intent expression of a connoisseur. He could have passed for one if necessary. Not only had he received an excellent education that included an appreciation of the fine arts, but he was a born actor. From his artfully cut blonde hair to his fashionable suit with its perfectly knotted tie and elegant pocket square, he looked as if he played polo in his spare time. The accent and manners were pure East Coast old money, and it wasn't an act. Julian's ancestors had not actually arrived on the Mayflower, but they had been on board a yacht that docked soon thereafter.
I assumed the notebook would be in Spencer's safe, Julian said.
He looked and sounded bored by the conversation.
It was the logical place to look, so I cracked it. Took me several minutes, by the way. When I realized the damn notebook wasn't inside, I searched the study in Spencer's bedroom. It would have been impossible to go through the entire house. The old mansion is huge. Spencer probably had a second safe, maybe one hidden in the floor.
Julian inhaled deeply on his cigarette. The brand was French. Very expensive. Very exclusive.
What did you expect me to do? He said.
He did not take his eyes off the portrait.
Pry up every floorboard in search of a hidden safe? Sorry, I'm not a carpenter. I don't do household remodeling work. You shouldn't have gotten rid of Spencer until you had that notebook in your hands. Spencer kept a gun in her bureau drawer. At some point, she became suspicious. She went for the weapon. I had no choice. It's not my fault I couldn't find the damned notebook. The client is not going to be pleased.
That's your problem, not mine. Your management, I'm just a field agent, remember?
True, I'm your only field agent, but nevertheless, I'm just hired help.
Graham ignored the barb.
Enright and Enright has a contract to recover the notebook and get rid of anyone who might have had access to it. I expect you to complete the assignment.
Julian turned around.
I'll be happy to make further inquiries, but I want something in return.
Graham controlled his temper with an effort. He was not in a position to bargain. The reputation of Enright and Enright was on the line.
What do you want? Graham asked. A promotion to vice president of the firm.
Graham pretended to give that some intense thought. Then he nodded curtly.
Very well, he said. But I will expect results, and I will expect them soon.
Julian's sensual mouth curved faintly. His gem-green eyes glinted with amusement.
You really are nervous about this contract, aren't you? I want it completed satisfactorily, yes. The client is a new one with very deep pockets and wide-ranging interests. If we are successful, there is the potential for a great deal of future business. You seem particularly keen to land this particular client. Why is it so important? It represents a golden opportunity for the firm to expand its business into the international sphere. That got Julian's attention, just as Graham had known it would. This client has international interests? Julian asked. Graham allowed himself a small, satisfied smile. It does, indeed. What sort of interests are we talking about? A wide variety. You read the newspapers. The modern world is an unstable place. Julian waved that aside. That's hardly a new development. The world has always been an unstable place. But until now, Enright and Enright has confined its activities to the United States. Graham pushed back his chair and got to his feet. He went to stand at the window. He had a spectacular view of New York City. But in his mind's eye, he saw Europe, the Middle East, Russia and beyond, all the way to the Far East. He intended to position the firm to take advantage of the opportunities that would abound in the future. It would be his legacy, he thought, the legacy that he would leave to his son and heir, who would, in turn, provide future generations of Enrights. Not that he planned to leave that legacy to his son any time soon. Graham was still in his prime, healthy and fit. He came from a long-lived line. Unfortunately, the men of the Enright line were not very prolific. After two wives, both deceased, he had managed to sire only one heir. The law firm of Enright and Enright had been founded by his father, Neville Enright, amid the chaos following the Civil War. Neville had understood that the desires for money and power and revenge were forms of lust, and therefore immutable aspects of human nature. Firms that catered to those elemental lusts would always prosper, regardless of stock market crashes and wars. On the surface, Enright & Enright was a respected law firm that specialized in estate planning for an exclusive wealthy clientele. But in addition, it provided very discreet services to those willing to resort to any means to achieve their objectives, so long as they could keep their own hands clean. For a hefty fee, Enright and Enright was willing to do the dirty work for its clients. In the aftermath of the war to end all wars, it had become clear to Graham that not only would there be more wars in the future, but there would also be an unlimited demand for the services that Enright and Enright provided. It had also become obvious that the rapid advances in modern technology, faster modes of transportation and communications, as well as more efficient weaponry, would open up new markets and new opportunities. "The times are changing," he said. "The firm must change with them. To do so, we must cultivate clients such as the one that has commissioned us to retrieve the notebook." "A client with international interests," Julian repeated softly. "Very interesting." He no longer sounded bored. There was something new in his voice. Anticipation. Graham was pleased and more than a little relieved. Satisfied, he turned around. "The only way to secure this client is to find the notebook and get rid of anyone who might be aware of its value," he said. "You will, of course, have the full resources of the firm at your disposal." Julian headed toward the door. "I'll get started immediately." "One moment, if you don't mind." Julian paused, his hand on the doorknob. "What is it?" "Can I assume you have some idea of where to start looking?" "Yes, as a matter of fact, I do," Julian said. "Spencer employed only three people. One of them has gone missing." Graham tensed. "Which one?" "The private secretary, Anna Harris, An orphan with no family, and, given her career, very little money. Unless she stole some from Spencer. She is the only member of the staff who disappeared, so it seems likely that she took the notebook.
I see.
The thing is, Anna Harris is not a professional like Spencer. She won't know how to go about making a deal for an item as dangerous as the notebook without revealing herself to someone who is watching for it to appear on the underground market. Someone like you. Thanks to the firm's connections, I can keep an eye on that market. Don't worry. Anna Harris and the notebook will show up sooner or later. And when they do, I'll deal with both issues. Why didn't you mention this before? Julian smiled his fallen angel smile. Because I wanted to know just how important this contract was to you.
I see.
What makes you think that this Anna Harris knows the value of the notebook? I'm sure of it because she fled without helping herself to the necklace that was in the safe. She must have seen it. Why would a poor secretary leave such a valuable item behind unless she thought she had something of even greater value to sell?
Good point, Graham said. But I must say, I'm surprised that Spencer confided the truth about the notebook to her secretary.
Julian's brows rose. Are you really? We both know that sooner or later private secretaries discover a great deal about their employer's confidential business. Graham grunted.
Very true.
It was unfortunate that the very qualities that made for a skilled secretary, intelligence, organizational talents, and the ability to anticipate her employer's needs before he was even aware of them, were the same qualities that eventually caused problems. He was always careful to hire experienced single women who lacked family and social connections. His current secretary was a fine example. Raina Kirk was in her 30s and alone in the world. There was no man in her life and no close relations. When it came time to let her go, there would be no problems.
Don't worry, Julian said. Anna Harris is just a secretary who made off with her employer's property. Her first objective will be to try to sell the notebook, but it will be difficult for her to find a buyer for such an exotic item. Once she starts putting out feelers, she'll give herself away very quickly.
Let's hope you're right. One more thing. Julian had been about to open the door. He sighed rather theatrically and turned back to face Graham.
What is it? He asked. Was it absolutely essential to make such a mess of the Spencer job? The murder is making headlines because the police believe that whoever killed the victim is a homicidal maniac.
Which distracts them from the true reason for the kill, Julian said with exaggerated patience.
That was the point. They are now looking for a madman, or possibly a madwoman. They won't make the connection to the notebook.
He let himself out into the reception area. Graham saw him give Raina a warm, seductive smile just before he closed the door. Graham sat down at his desk. Julian's explanation for the bloody death was reasonable, but he could have taken a less spectacular approach. A motor vehicle accident or a suicide might have generated headlines. Helen Spencer moved in society, but neither would have involved the police. He realized that what concerned him was Julian's penchant for the sensational. He clearly enjoyed the thrill of the kill. Graham understood. We're only young once, he reminded himself. Nevertheless, it was time that Julian matured and learned to control his impulsive nature. Graham contemplated the portrait of himself that hung on the wall. The artist Tamara Dolempitska, had used her talent to give him an aura of mystery and glamour. He appeared both intensely masculine and darkly sensual. The light turned his blonde hair to gold, his green eyes glowed like jewels. Lempitska had called him Lucifer during the sittings and tried to seduce him. Her illicit liaisons were the stuff of legend. He smiled at the memory. Better to reign in hell, he thought, especially when one commanded such a profitable version of Hades. He was untroubled by the thoughts of heaven and hell because he was not a religious man. He did not consider himself a vain man either, but he had to admit that he was quietly pleased with the portrait. He was some 30 years older than Julian, but the similarity between the two of them was unmistakable. Anyone who saw Julian standing next to the Lempitska portrait would recognize the truth immediately. Like father, like son. Chapter 3. When Chicago was several miles behind her, Irene pulled off Route 66 to spend yet another night at yet another anonymous auto camp. After a dinner of stew and homemade biscuits, she retired to her cabin and took the notebook out of the handbag. She had glanced at it briefly the night she fled the mansion, but she had been too focused on getting away from New York to take a closer look. She sat on the edge of the cot and examined it by the light of the kerosene lantern. There was a name on the first page. It had been written in a tight, precise hand. Dr. Thomas G. Atherton. Below the name was a phone number. The rest of the pages appeared to be covered in some sort of code, all of it in the same handwriting. She puzzled over the strange numbers and symbols for a time, before it dawned on her that she was looking at scientific notations. It struck her that she was in possession of the personal notebook of a mathematician or a chemist, but that made no sense. Helen Spencer had never displayed any interest in either subject. At dawn, Irene awoke from a restless sleep without a sense of resolve. She was running. She needed to know more about what she was running from. After a breakfast of eggs and toast, she used the autocamp phone booth to call the number on the first page of the notebook. The operator requested several coins. "Where is this number located?" Irene asked, chucking money into the slot. "New Jersey," the operator said. A moment later, a polished female voice answered. "Saltwood Laboratory, how may I direct your call?" Irene took a deep breath. "Dr. Atherton, please." There was a short, brittle pause on the other end of the line. "I'm sorry, but Dr. Atherton is no longer with us."
"Do you mean he is no longer employed there?"
"Unfortunately, Dr. Atherton is deceased. Would you care to speak to someone else in his department?"
"No. What happened to Dr. Atherton?" There was another short pause on the other end of the line before the receptionist spoke.
"I'm sorry. Who did you say was calling?"
"Looks like I've got the wrong Atherton," Irene said. "Sorry for the inconvenience."
She hung up the phone and got back on the road. Two people connected to the notebook were dead. That did not bode well for her future. She would have to do a very good job of disappearing. Chapter 4. Burning Cove, California, 4 months later. Irene stopped at the edge of the long lap pool and looked down at the body sprawled gracefully on the bottom. It was 15 minutes past midnight.
The lights had been dimmed in the grand spa chamber, but in the low glow of a nearby wall sconce, it was possible to make out the dead woman's hair floating around her pretty face in a nightmarish imitation of a wedding veil. Irene turned away from the pool, intending to run to the entrance of the spa to summon help. Somewhere in the shadows, shoe leather scraped on tiles. She knew then that she was not alone with the dead woman. There was a faint click, and the wall sconces went dark. The vast spa chamber was abruptly plunged into dense shadows. The only light now was the ghostly glow from the moon. It illuminated the section of the spa where Irene stood. She might as well have been pinned in a spotlight. Her pulse pounded, and she was suddenly fighting to breathe. The nearest exit was the row of French doors behind her, but they were on the opposite side of the long lap pool. The side door that she had used to enter the spa was even farther away. She concluded that her best option was to sound as if she was in command of herself and the situation. "There's been an accident," she said, raising her voice in what she hoped was a firm, authoritative manner. "A woman fell into the water. We've got to get her out. There might still be time to revive her." That was highly unlikely. The woman at the bottom of the pool looked very, very dead. There was no response. No one moved in the shadows. Somewhere in the darkness, water dripped, the faint sound echoing eerily. The humid atmosphere was rapidly becoming oppressive. There were two possible reasons why the other person on the scene might not come forward, Irene thought. The first was fear of scandal. The Burning Cove Hotel was one of the most exclusive on the West Coast. Located almost 100 miles north of Los Angeles, it offered a guarantee of privacy and discretion to those who could afford it. If the rumors were true, it had sheltered a list of guests that ranged from powerful figures of the criminal underworld to Hollywood stars and European royalty. Times might be hard elsewhere in the country, but you'd never know it from the luxury and opulence of the Burning Cove Hotel. The stars and aspiring stars came to the hotel to escape the prying eyes of the always hungry reporters of the Los Angeles newspapers and the Hollywood gossip columnists. So yes, it was possible that the watcher in the shadows feared being discovered in the vicinity of a woman who had just drowned. That kind of scandal could certainly taint a budding film career. But there was another reason the other person might not want to assist in what would no doubt be a futile rescue effort. Perhaps he or she had been directly responsible for the death of the woman in the pool. The thought that she might be trying to coax a killer out of hiding sent another jolt through Irene. She decided to make a run back to the side door. But she had waited too long. Running footsteps sounded in the darkness, ringing and echoing off the tiled walls and floor. The other person was not fleeing the scene, Irene realized. Instead, he or she, it was impossible to tell which, was coming toward her. Standing there in the glowing moonlight and silhouetted against the wall of glass doors behind her on the far side of the lap pool, she made an ideal target. She kicked off her shoes, whirled around, and hurled her handbag across the narrow lap pool. She had spent her youth pitching hay and stacking firewood. She was tall for a woman, and the single life had kept her fit and strong. A lady on her own in the world could not afford the luxury of being delicate. The handbag landed on the tiles on the opposite side of the pool with a solid thud. She jumped into the water and started swimming. She would reach the opposite side within seconds. Unless the watcher followed her into the water, she would have a good chance of escape. There was no way the other person could get around either end of the pool in time to intercept her. She was a good swimmer, but her fashionable wide-legged trousers were immediately transformed into lead weights. She swam harder, resisting the downward pull of the clothing. It was not the first time that she had gone into water fully dressed. There had been a river near the farm where she was raised. Her grandfather had made certain that she learned how to swim almost as soon as she learned how to walk. The knowledge that she was swimming over the body of the dead woman was unnerving, but not nearly as unnerving as the realization that she was probably being chased by a killer. She reached the far side and dragged herself up out of the water. It took every ounce of strength she possessed, but she discovered that fear was a terrific motivator. She managed to scramble to her feet. Breathless, she paused to look back. She saw no one in the shadows, but she heard rapid footsteps again. This time they were headed away from the pool. A short time later, a door opened and closed on the far side of the spa chamber. Irene gripped the handle of her handbag and hurried to the glass doors that fronted the spa. She fled into the moonlit gardens. Once again, she was running from the scene of a murder, running from a killer. Just when she had begun to think that her new life in California might have a Hollywood ending. Chapter 5.
Now that Detective Brandon and the officers have taken their leave, Miss Glasson, I think you and I should have a private conversation, Oliver Ward said.
Irene considered her options. She had an uneasy feeling that her first choice, concocting an excuse to decline the chat, was not going to work. In her short time in California, she had learned to expect the unexpected. And Oliver Ward definitely qualified as a disturbing example of the unexpected. She glanced across the living room, gauging the distance between the big leather armchair in which she sat and the front door. She just might make it. She had one very big advantage. Ward had a bad leg. His gait was stiff and halting. He was forced to rely on a cane. The cause of the injury was no secret. It was, in fact, something of a show business legend. Oliver Ward was once a world-famous magician who had performed amazing illusions at some of the biggest theaters in the United States. He had toured Europe, but 2 years ago things had gone terribly wrong. Ward was nearly killed in what proved to be his final performance. The disaster made headlines across the country. Blood on the stage. Famous magician badly injured in front of audience. May not survive. What precisely had gone wrong had been a matter of conjecture in the press for months. All anyone knew for certain was that there had been real ammunition in the gun that was used in the illusion. Ward had steadfastly refused to give any interviews on the subject. After he was released from the hospital, he had seemingly vanished from the scene. Tonight, Irene discovered that he had gone into the hotel business. At the moment, he was on the far side of the room, standing at an elegant black lacquer liquor cabinet, where he was in the process of pouring two whiskies. He appeared to be in excellent health, but given his serious limp, she was almost certain she could get to the door before he could. It was, however, highly unlikely that she could escape the grounds without being stopped. Ward employed an impressive array of well-dressed security guards. Their evening uniforms consisted of black and white formal attire, but the good clothes did not disguise their muscular builds. Not that any of them had been around earlier in the spa when she could have used a little help. Just like cops, she thought, never around when you needed one. She abandoned the idea of making a dash for the door. "It's been a very trying night," she said instead, striving to appear pathetic. She certainly looked the part, swathed in a thick spa robe with her hair bound up in a turban made from a hotel towel. "I'm exhausted. If you don't mind, I would like to go back to the Cove Inn. I've got a room there. Perhaps we could talk in the morning."
With a little luck, she would be in her car, heading back to Los Angeles before Ward realized she had left town.
"I'd prefer to have the conversation now," he said.
She abandoned the pathetic approach and went for icy outrage.
"Detective Brandon declined to arrest me," she said. "Most likely because I'm innocent. Are you planning to keep me here against my will? Because if so, I would like to remind you that I am a member of the press. I'm sure you don't want this scandal to get any bigger than it is already."
All right. Claiming to be a member of the press was pushing things a bit. Technically, she was a mere assistant at Whispers, a Hollywood gossip paper. But she was in Burning Cove with her editor's approval, and she was on the trail of what she was sure would be a headline-making story. Murder and scandal that involved a leading man who was considered by many to be the next Clark Gable. A short time ago, Ward had summoned his manager and the head concierge. They had been instructed to do everything in their power to staunch rumors and speculation. Their primary job was to keep the press at bay. The fact that it was a reporter, or an aspiring reporter, who had found the body in the spa was going to be a very big problem for Oliver Ward. She could expect threats, she thought, but Ward had to know it was unlikely that any force on Earth could squelch the story of murder in his hotel spa. Furthermore, she doubted that Ward would want to add fuel to the fire by ordering his people to forcibly detain her. Not in front of witnesses, at least. Unfortunately, at the moment, there were no witnesses. She was alone with Oliver Ward in the living room of his private villa, Casa del Mar.
"We both know that there is no avoiding the headlines," Oliver said. He put the stopper back into the cut glass decanter. "The best I can do at this point is try to contain and control the story."
"At least you are honest about your intentions. How do you intend to contain and control the scandal?" He gave her a cool, assessing smile.
"I'm working on that problem. Perhaps you can help me."
"Why?"
"It would be in your own best interests."
She managed what she hoped was a smile as cold as his own.
"Threats, Mr. Ward?"
"I never make threats, just statements of fact. I do have some questions I would like to ask before you leave here tonight."
Oliver picked up one of the glasses and turned to face her.
"Save yourself the effort of making a run for the front door. It's true that I am no longer a working magician, but I've still got a few tricks up my sleeve. I'm not quite as slow as I appear."
She believed him.
"I don't care if you are the owner of this hotel, Mr. Ward," she said. "You have no right to keep me a prisoner here."
"I hope you will consider yourself my guest," Oliver said.
He gripped his cane and made his way across the living room.
"You are, after all, sitting in my home wearing a robe and slippers provided by my hotel."
He stopped in front of her and held out the glass of whiskey. She was briefly distracted by the masculine grace of the gesture. In his hands, the glass seemed to materialize out of thin air. She looked up from the glass and found herself briefly ensnared by his compelling eyes. They were an unusual color, a feral shade of dark amber. She refused to admit that there was anything genuinely mesmeric about his gaze, but she was intensely aware of the sheer power of his will. She was dealing with a very intelligent, very cool-headed man. She was certain that once he settled on a goal or a course of action, it would be difficult, make that impossible, to distract him or turn him aside. It wasn't just his eyes that caught and held her attention. He was not handsome in the way of the leading men of the silver screen, but there was a certain kind of raw power about his boldly carved features, broad shoulders and lean build. Oliver Ward possessed that magical quality called presence. No wonder he had been able to enthrall audiences.
Her first inclination was to refuse the whiskey. She needed to keep her wits about her. But her nerves deserved some consideration, she thought. The events in the spa had rattled her. She took the whiskey and swallowed a healthy dose of the spirits. The stuff burned all the way down, but it had a fortifying effect. She immediately regretted the action, because Oliver looked quietly pleased. Too late now, she decided. She took another sip. Oliver went back across the room and picked up the other glass. He made his way to the big, heavily padded chair across from her and lowered himself into it. He stretched out his bad leg with some care.
"Tell me again how you managed to get access to my hotel," he said.
"You heard me explain to Detective Brandon that Gloria Maitland asked me to meet her in the spa. She left my name at the front desk. I was her guest for the evening."
"The guest of a woman who is now dead."
"Are you implying I'm responsible? Detective Brandon certainly didn't seem to think so." But she was clutching at straws now. Brandon had been summoned by the head of hotel security. He had arrived with an officer from the Burning Cove Police Department. It was obvious that the detective had been roused from his bed, but he was professional and polite. Unfortunately, it had also been evident from the moment he arrived that he and Oliver Ward were well acquainted. Irene had no doubt but that Brandon would defer to Ward's desire to try to contain the scandal. Burning Cove might be a small town, but it appeared to operate under L.A. rules. Money and power controlled everything, including the local police.
"I checked with the front desk," Oliver said. "While it's true that Miss Maitland invited you here this evening, she failed to mention that you were a member of the press. Reporters are never allowed on the property."
"Yes. Well, I'm afraid you'll have to take that up with Miss Maitland."
"Who is now deceased. We keep coming back to that unpleasant fact, don't we?"
"It's not my fault that Gloria Maitland didn't obey your rules," Irene said. "And while we're on the subject of security, it would appear that the Burning Cove Hotel has a few problems in that regard. A woman was murdered in your fancy spa tonight. That doesn't make your security people look good, does it?"
"No," Oliver conceded. "But the fact that you were the one who found the body doesn't make you look good." He paused a beat. "Some would say that makes you the primary suspect."
"Don't panic," she thought. "There will be plenty of time to do that later." "I told Detective Brandon the truth," she said, managing to keep her voice steady. "I'm a journalist. I had an appointment with Miss Maitland. She chose the time and the location."
"You work for a Hollywood gossip sheet. I'm not sure that position entitles you to call yourself a journalist."
"You are hardly in a position to lecture me on the subject of sensational headlines. You're an ex-magician who built a name for himself by making exactly those kinds of headlines with your very daring performances. I'm sure that when you were touring, you wanted all the newspaper coverage you could get."
"I'm in a different profession these days."
"We both know that your patrons don't just come to the Burning Cove Hotel because they crave privacy. The actors and actresses book rooms here because they want to be seen checking in to such an exclusive establishment. The rich come because they want to rub shoulders with the famous and the infamous. Admit it, Mr. Ward, people are attracted to this hotel precisely because they want their names mentioned in the same breath as Hollywood royalty and wealthy tycoons and notorious gangsters. Your guests will do just about anything to be the subject of the kind of journalism that appears in whispers." To her chagrin, Oliver inclined his head once in acknowledgement of the counterattack.
"That's all true," he said. "However, I'm sure you understand that the policy against allowing journalists onto the grounds is part of the illusion. Obviously, if I did let them wander around the hotel, it would no longer appear exclusive."
"It's all about appearances, then?"
It's all about maintaining the illusion, Miss Glasson.
What do you want from me, Mr. Ward?
He turned the whiskey glass absently between his fingers.
Tonight, a woman died in my hotel under mysterious circumstances, he said. You claim that you had an appointment with her in the spa. That appointment was at a rather late hour.
A quarter past midnight, and it didn't strike me as a strange time at all. It made perfect sense. Your hotel was in full swing at that hour. The lounge was crowded. People were dancing, drinking heavily, and no doubt meeting other people, spouses and lovers in various rooms and pool cabanas. Gloria Maitland had every reason to think that no one would notice her slipping off to the spa for an interview with a journalist.
You seem to have a somewhat jaded view of what goes on here at the Burning Cove.
Irene gave him her best, "You can trust me, everything is off the record," smile.
Care to set me straight?
I never discuss the personal lives of my guests.
Of course not.
I would like to know what you expected to learn from Maitland.
We're back to that, are we?
I'm afraid so.
There was something implacable about Oliver Ward. Short of screaming for help, she did not see an easy way out of the situation. Given that he owned the hotel and paid the salaries of everyone who worked there, she was not certain that screaming for help would be of much use. It occurred to her that there was another angle to consider as well. If there was one thing she had learned in her short career at Whispers, it was that two could play the information game. Trying to give the impression that she was willing to humor him, she sank deeper into her chair. The effect of languid grace was somewhat marred because she had to fumble with the oversized robe to make certain that it did not fall open. She was not wearing anything underneath. All of her clothes had been handed off to the housekeeping department for cleaning and drying. To his credit, Oliver's fierce eyes never once dropped below her face. Either he was a real gentleman, or he was not attracted to women, she thought. Her feminine intuition told her that the latter was not the case. She decided there was a third possibility. He simply wasn't interested in her. You heard me answer all of Detective Brandon's questions, she said. Gloria Maitland phoned me long distance at my office in L.A. yesterday. I might add that she reversed the charges. My boss was not pleased with that.
You told Detective Brandon that Maitland was vague about why she wanted to speak to you, yet you made the long drive from Los Angeles to keep the appointment.
She assured me that the gossip she had for me was very hot. To be honest, Mr. Ward, I could use a good story. I'm relatively new at Whispers. I'm trying to make my mark. If I don't come up with a solid headline soon, I might be looking for other employment. All I can tell you is that I went to the spa a little after midnight, just as Gloria Maitland instructed. She was dead at the bottom of the pool when I arrived.
Oliver narrowed his eyes ever so slightly.
You said someone else was there.
Yes, I wasn't sure at first, but then I heard the footsteps. Someone was running toward me. That made me very nervous. I went into the water to avoid him. That's it. I don't know what else I can tell you.
You went into the water to avoid him?
Yes.
You told Detective Brandon that you weren't sure if the other person was a man or a woman.
Sound echoes in your spa, Mr. Ward. Also, I couldn't see anything clearly, just shadows. I can't be absolutely certain whether it was a man or a woman who ran toward me. I have to admit, I wasn't paying close attention to the details.
But your first thought was that the other person was a man.
Irene drank some more of her whiskey, while she recalled the scene in the spa. She nodded once.
Yes, she said, I'm almost sure of it.
What makes you almost sure?
Irene eyed him warily. Why are you pushing so hard on this particular subject?
Because I think that you have a specific reason to believe that the person who murdered Gloria Maitland was male.
Oliver paused for emphasis.
Perhaps because of what Maitland said to you in that phone call that made you get into a car and drive all the way to Burning Cove to meet her.
Irene took a deep breath and exhaled slowly.
Good guess, Mr. Ward. Yes, I have a reason to think that Gloria Maitland might have been murdered by a man.
While I'm on a roll, I'm going to make another guess. You didn't drive all the way to Burning Cove just to pick up a little Hollywood gossip from an aspiring actress. I'm sure you've got better sources in Los Angeles.
I think you came here for a very specific reason. So I'm going to ask you again. What did Gloria Maitland tell you in that phone call that brought you to this town and my hotel?
Irene rocked her glass back and forth a little, sending the whiskey into a slow swirl. In the past 9 days, she had chased too many false leads and run into too many stone walls. She had nothing left to lose. She set the whiskey glass aside and met Oliver Ward's unusual eyes.
I came here to meet Gloria Maitland because she said she had something very important to tell me about Nick Tremaine.
The actor?
Oliver sounded curious but not startled, Irene thought.
Yes, Mr. Ward, the actor. I'm sure you know him. I believe that he is currently registered here as a guest. Tremaine and Maitland were involved in an affair that ended rather badly, at least from Maitland's point of view. But I'm sure you know that. The news was in all the Hollywood papers.
I never give out personal information on my guests, Oliver said.
Yes, you keep mentioning that policy. Look, I'm not asking you to confirm or deny Tremaine's presence in this hotel. I know he's here, because Gloria Maitland told me that much when she called my office.
You think that the other person in the spa tonight was Tremaine?
It wasn't a question. She was on treacherous ground now. Nick Tremaine was under contract with one of the most powerful movie studios in Hollywood. His first film, Sea of Shadows, had been an unexpected hit. His latest, Fortune's Rogue, had transformed Tremaine from rising talent to box office gold. He was suddenly worth a lot of money to his employers, which meant that they would go to great lengths to protect their investment. She had been in Los Angeles long enough to know that the men at the top of the big studios ran Hollywood, and by extension, much of the city of Los Angeles. They routinely paid off cops, judges, and assorted politicians, making an inexperienced reporter from a small-time gossip paper disappear would be no problem at all. She had to be very careful. The studio execs weren't the only ones with a vested interest in Nick Tremaine. Oliver Ward made a very good living providing at least the illusion of privacy to his Hollywood clientele. He had every reason to protect guests like Tremaine. She had probably said far too much already, thanks to the whiskey and the state of her nerves. Time to take a step back. She managed a steely smile.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Mr. Ward. I wouldn't dream of implying that I thought Nick Tremaine was the other person in your spa tonight.
He accepted that statement with equanimity. He had probably seen it coming, she decided.
I understand your reluctance to confide in me, he said. But if you're telling the truth about what happened this evening, then you might want to reconsider.
Why would I do that?
Because if you're being honest, then I give you my word that we share the same goal.
Which is?
Finding out who killed Gloria Maitland.
She went very still. For some inexplicable reason, she was inclined to believe him. But she had learned the hard way that her intuition was not to be trusted.
What happens if it turns out that one of your guests is the killer? She asked. A wealthy guest who has powerful connections? One who has every reason to expect you to keep his or her secrets? Oliver gave her a politely quizzical look.
If my guests choose to assume that I will keep all of their secrets, that's up to them.
But you allow them to think that you will protect them.
My services do not extend to protecting a killer.
She gripped the lapels of her robe. I want to go back to the Cove Inn now, Mr. Ward. I need to think about this.
If you insist.
He pushed himself to his feet and gripped his cane.
You said you left your car on a side road behind the hotel.
She leaped to her feet. Yes, I didn't want to ask one of the valets to park it for me.
In case you decided to leave in a hurry and didn't want to have to wait while the valet fetched your vehicle? Never mind. You don't have to answer that question. I'll walk you to your car.
That's not necessary, really.
It's going on 2 in the morning, Miss Glasson, and if you are telling the truth, there is a murderer on the loose. He or she may still be on the grounds of this hotel. I insist on seeing you safely off the premises.
He had a point, she thought. The one thing she knew for certain tonight was that Oliver Ward was not the person she had encountered in the spa chamber. The killer had not limped or used a cane. There was another reason she was sure that Ward was not the murderer. She had a feeling that if he wanted to get rid of someone, he would handle the business with efficiency and finesse. He would have created a convincing illusion of an accident. But not even the most practiced killer could plan for every detail, she reminded herself. Sometimes things went wrong, even for one of the world's greatest magicians. Oliver Ward, after all, was in a new line of work because 2 years ago things had gone very, very wrong for him. Chapter 6. The shrill screech of the printing machine hurt Oliver's ears and made conversation in a normal tone of voice impossible. He looked at his uncle, who was watching the stylus move slowly back and forth across the paper, with the air of an alchemist observing the results of his latest attempt to transmute lead into gold.
"Can you shut that damn thing down?" Oliver said, projecting his voice the way he had once done on stage. "Almost finished with the test run!" Chester yelled back. "I'm telling you, Oliver, this machine is the future of newspapers. All you need is a radio equipped with a printing device like this one."
With his wild mane of gray hair, round gold-rimmed spectacles and faded coveralls, Chester Ward looked like a cross between an absent-minded professor and an eccentric mechanic. The reality was that he was a combination of both. He was an inventor. Chester loved to take machines apart to see how they worked. When he was satisfied that he understood the design of a particular instrument or device, he invariably made some modifications and reassembled it in a way that made it function faster or more efficiently, or even perform an entirely different task. He currently held a number of patents on everything from slot machines to hydrofoil engines. Unfortunately, the hydrofoil design had failed to catch the attention of the military, so there was no income from that source. The slot machine patent was a very different story. Chester had licensed his design to a man with extensive interest in the gaming industry. Luther Pell had recently installed the Chess J. Ward gaming machines in his Reno casino and his offshore gambling ship anchored in Santa Monica Bay. It was hard to go broke in the gaming business, Oliver reflected. Chester might never have another money-making patent, but he wouldn't need one. The steady income from the slot machines guaranteed him the cash he needed to finance his endless projects. It was Chester's innovative machines and devices that had elevated the amazing Oliver Ward show to a level never before seen in the world of magic. Until disaster had struck, Oliver had been well on his way to joining the ranks of Houdini and Blackstone, and Chester had been his secret weapon. Chester could design and build anything that Oliver had been able to imagine. Audiences had left the theater thrilled by a flawless performance of magic and convinced that they had witnessed